Hi, this is Pastor Mark Azil, the LCMS Director of Campus Ministry and LCMSU, inviting all college students and those with an interest in campus ministry to join us for Taboo, the 2015 National LCMS Campus Ministry Conference, this coming January 5th through 7th at St. Louis University in St. Louis. That's right, it's Taboo in the Lou. Find out more at lcms.org/LCMSU.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's kind of one of those things some people might consider it an anachronism, a throwback to a time, a quainter time, when we made these kinds of distinctions routinely without thinking because we were less enlightened than we are today. You had boys' teams, you had girls' teams, and the boys played on the boys' teams and the girls played on the girls' teams. And that was, of course, before we had this category of transgenderedness. I think that's the term, transgenderedness, where someone hasn't made up their mind or is in the process of moving from one to another or perhaps considers themselves neither boy nor girl. What do you do with a kid like that when it comes to high school sports? High school sports seems a trivial battleground for the gender wars, but that's exactly where it's taking place in the state of Minnesota. Joining us to talk about plans to eradicate gender distinctions in high school sports there in the state of Minnesota, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morris, founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the books Smart Sex and Love in Economics. Jennifer, welcome back.
Hi, Todd. Thanks for having me.
Why should anyone care? It's high school sports. It's games, after all.
Well, high school sports are very important to people. I mean, Todd, you live in the Midwest. High school sports are like a sacrament out there. What are you saying?
Well, that's true.
It's just high school sports. It's unimportant, you know. But in all seriousness, I mean, this is a place where young men and young women learn to use their bodies and learn to live in their bodies and learn how to compete and learn how to win and how to lose, and they learn many, many things that have to do with character. And the feminist movement for years has spent enormous amounts of energy and time and money and social capital in making sure that every girl has the opportunity to play sports if she so desires. And now those very same girls are going to look around and find themselves playing sports with or against boys who believe they're girls or who want to believe they're girls or who for that day believe they're girls. I don't quite know how all the choice making is going to unfold here, but for girls to be having to compete against boys for athletics is certainly not something that's going to enhance the self-esteem of women athletes. It's going to create a different kind of inequality and segregation.
I mean, there's a whole, I believe, a chapter in education law having to do with what is essentially, for lack of a better word, separate but equal when it comes to both high school and college sports. There are certain mandates in place here, and it's hard for me to imagine someone says, I'm biologically a boy, I'd like to play on the girls' high school volleyball team because I feel out of place in this boy's body. I consider myself a girl. I can't imagine how you even begin to address that legally.
I can't imagine it either. And I honestly, I think that the small number of children who might actually be in this situation, I think whatever issues those children have should be addressed some other way. So if it's really an authentic case where there's a boy who feels that they have some kind of gender dysphoria and a gender identity issue, and they believe they're a girl, they want to be a girl, they should be allowed to, you know, if you're going to allow them to have whatever kind of therapy they think is appropriate, I think they should just accept the fact that they're not going to get to play that kind of sport, if it's a contact sport or something like that, where boys and girls are significantly different in their capabilities. You should just accept that you're not going to get to play sports. You got other things to worry about, kiddo. We're going to help you deal with your issues as best we can. Right now, we don't know how to deal with the issues of transgenderism. I mean, I think science doesn't really know. Medicine doesn't know. Medicine knows how to detach body parts and put on new body parts and give hormone therapy. We know how to do that kind of stuff. But there's a whole range of psychological wellness where I think we really don't know what we're doing. And so to completely reorient all of high school sports for all kids on the basis of trying to help a handful of kids with a solution that we don't even know is appropriate, that just doesn't work, you know. That, and it bespeaks a larger agenda that doesn't really have to do with those particular children and their particular needs. It's part of the larger sexual revolutionary agenda.
So how does it fit in that? How is this move in Minnesota to eliminate gender distinction in high school sports part of a larger sexual revolution agenda?
Well, as we've talked about before, Todd, the sexual revolution has two pieces to it. The first big piece is that sex and procreation should be separated from one another, and they should both be separated from marriage. That's the first big idea of the sexual revolution. And of course, lots of things spin off from that idea, and we've talked about that many times on this program. But now we're talking about the second big point of the sexual revolution, which is the idea that men and women are really completely interchangeable, and that any differences you see between men and women are all socially constructed. And so, therefore, we should be doing everything we can to eliminate all kinds of sex differentiation, sexual differentiation. And so the way transgenderism fits into that is that transgenderism, in a sense, is the ultimate in social construction of gender, right? Because you are the gender that you choose to be. Your body is not a constraint anymore, right? So the sexual revolution resents the gendered nature of the human body, resents the fact that we're male and female. And so they've developed this language that says sex is about the body and gender is about everything that's social, all the social parts. And so they've spent years saying sex isn't really that important. The body is not really that important. The body you're born in is not that important. You can change. And so now, and the idea of that was to say, well, the part that can be constructed is what's really significant. Therefore, we're going to reconstruct it the way we want, and the body shouldn't constrain us in that project. So now we're taking the next step and saying the body is so unimportant that we can reconstruct the body too if we want to, right? And so it's kind of the ultimate in the gender ideology aspect of the sexual revolution. And therefore, even if it's just about sports, even if it's not in your state, you need to take it seriously. The fact that it sounds crazy and goofy to you is no barrier whatsoever to the people who are committed to this movement pushing forward with their agenda. It's no barrier at all. The fact that it's impossible and strikes you as crazy, that's not relevant. You need to take it seriously, people.
I want to read to you an excerpt from the National Federation of State High School Associations. What they have to say about transgendered kids in high school and get your reaction. Here it is. It is important for policymakers to understand that transgendered girls who were assigned a male gender at birth are not boys. Their consistent and affirmed gender identity as girls is as deep-seated as the gender identity of non-transgendered girls. The belief that the transgendered girls are not real girls is something sometimes expressed as a concern that allowing transgender girls to compete on girls' teams displaces opportunities for real girls to participate. What does that mean? What's going on?
Well, go back to the very early part of the quotation that you read. There's so much ideology packed into that, okay? So did you hear the terminology they used? The gender assigned at birth. Read that part again. I want your listeners to really hear that. Read that again. What did it say?
It is important for policymakers to understand that transgendered girls, parenthetically, who were assigned a male gender at birth are not boys.
Hold that right there. Okay. What they're trying to say is that when a baby is born and you look down and you say, hey, that's a little boy, they're saying you are not recognizing a reality. You are assigning a social construct to that child when you say, hey, it's a boy, okay? That's what they're after, Todd, and that is no small thing, all right? So they want you to conform to this child's view of themselves, but really what they're saying is that you must conform to the state's view of reality, which is gender is assigned and not real. That's where this is all going, okay? So one thing your listeners might want to know is I put a link to all this on the Ruth Institute Facebook page, including a link to the Minnesota Family Council. So if you have relatives in Minnesota or if you're listening online from Minnesota, please take a look at what the Minnesota Family Council has to say about this. Because this hasn't passed yet, right? And people can still have the opportunity to educate themselves about it and be involved if they want to.
So are they saying, in essence, that, you know, I go on Facebook and I see one of my friends posts a picture of a baby. It says, I just saw this just today. A friend says, my first grandson. If he's doing that, according to this way of thinking, this worldview, he's just made a bigoted statement.
Exactly. That's exactly right. And there was an article not too long ago about it, about how it's harmful to all children to assign them a gender at birth. Okay. And see, this is part of the fruit of redefining marriage. Okay. And, you know, you and I have talked many times about the long-term implication of removing the gender requirement for marriage, you know, and we thought, well, you know, you redefine marriage, you're going to redefine parenthood. We don't like that. That's not a good thing. You're going to remove the gender requirement. You're going to remove the requirement there's only two people. You know, many things we have talked about as a consequence of redefining marriage. This is a whole new area that you and I haven't really explored very much before, which is that when you remove the gender requirement for marriage, you're giving life to the idea that men and women are completely interchangeable. And if you believe that, which advocates of redefining marriage certainly do believe that, if you believe that, then the next logical step is transgenderism. You know, in the sense that this is where the individual gets to choose their gender, and it's no longer assigned at birth. The body, the human body, is not significant. That's what they're saying here. See? And so that was embedded in the whole debate over same-sex marriage. That's why it was so important that we never really talk about issues very deeply, that we just keep it at this superficial level of equality and, you know, do we love our gay neighbors? That's all they ever wanted to talk about, because this was lurking in the shadows all along. The idea that behind the understanding of marriage that they were importing into the law, they're also importing an understanding of the human body itself. And so that's what we're now dealing with. That's going to be playing out as well. So all of you who aren't sure what you think about the marriage question, I want you to reopen the question and think about the fact, do you really think it's true that when a baby's born and you say it's a boy, that you've done something wrong to that child? You know?
Well, one final question for you. It's hard for me to imagine, say, the hypothetical gay man who's listening to us, who's proud to be gay and a man. He identifies as a man. And part of his identity as a gay man is that he's a man and that he desires other men. Okay, it's hard for me to imagine, if he sits down and think about it, that he wants the next step to be taken, where his identity is simply a construct of his mind, or where he's in essence being told your gender is in essence a fiction that you get to write yourself.
Yes, and you are correct, Todd. Although you won't see this in mainstream publications, there are debates and arguments about this very thing inside the gay community. You know, that not every gay person, not every gay organization is on board with the whole transgender agenda. And although I don't want to comment on that too much, because I don't follow it that closely, but I follow it closely enough to know that the point you just raised has occurred to quite a few people, you know. And there are people who want to say that transgenderism is an illness because they want to be able to have their sexual reassignment surgery paid for by insurance. And if it's not an illness, it doesn't get paid for. You know, that line of thought, that line of debate, that is going on inside parts of the sexual minority community, if you want to call it that. So it's not an, you know, open and shut done deal. I mean, the other thing that's strange about the whole thing is that we have been sold on the idea that that sexual orientation is something completely fixed, completely immutable. You can't possibly change it. If you're a gay man and you don't want to be a gay man, there's nothing you can do about it. What you need to do is to go into therapy that affirms your gayness so that you can get over it, so you can be comfortable who you are. Now you've got a person of any age, a child, an adult, doesn't matter, and they say, I'm uncomfortable inside my gendered body. I don't like the gender that I am. And now people are saying, well, the thing for you to do is to change your body. By golly, we're not going to give you therapy to affirm you in the body that you have. We're going to redo your body. You see, those two things seem to be contradictory until you realize that what is really at stake here is the question of whether you're going to recognize gender as a legitimate thing at all, right? And so what they're after is a genderless world where it's all socially constructed. You know, if everything significant about male and female is really socially constructed, that gives the social engineers the widest possible berth for reconstructing, right? Reconstructing the world into their image. Whereas if I'm a girl and you're a boy, and I'm always going to be a girl and you're always going to be a boy, and there are some things that are different about us, well, that puts some limits on what you can socially construct and reconstruct. And so those natural limits, nature itself, is the enemy of this agenda. So this whole part of the sexual revolutionary agenda has to do with technology and social engineering overriding what is natural and what is nature. That's the idea, the hostility to the human body.
With only about 30 seconds here, Jennifer, what would the gender neutrality police think about, you know, me or my daughter giving her first kid a male or a female name? Are we going to be forced to use only gender-neutral names lest we bigot our children with their names?
Boy, I don't know, Todd. I don't know. That could be involved. But what I want you to see, though, is the totalitarian nature of this movement that has you even asking a question like that. How could it ever possibly be part of the government's business whether you what you name your child and how you raise your child? You see, this ideology, because it's impossible to wipe out all the differences between men and women, because it's impossible, and yet the people see it as a high moral goal to implement it, it will be a totalitarian movement. It has to be, because they've got to use a lot of force to overwrite nature on the scale that they're trying to override it. So I don't know if they'll do that particular thing, but they got a lot of things that they can do and intend to do.
Folks, you can check out the blog and the website for the Ruth Institute. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand. Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is a regular guest, founding president of the Ruth Institute based in San Marcos, California. She taught economics for 15 years at Yale and George Mason Universities, and she's author of the book Smart Sex and Love in Economics. Jennifer, thank you very much for your time.
You're welcome.
When we come back, we're going to spend some time with Ken Samples. Perhaps you've thought about it, especially with all of the science fiction. I just watched the next Star Wars trailer. There it was. It's short and sweet and intriguing, and it's science fiction. It deals with extraterrestrial life and life on far distant worlds in a galaxy far, far away and long, long ago. Well, if it really existed, if extraterrestrial life really existed, would it bring an end to all religion and to Christianity in particular? If the aliens actually came down and landed there on the lawn of the White House or wherever, your front lawn, would it destroy the premise, the truth of the Christian faith? We'll talk about that with Ken Samples of Reasons to Believe right after that. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Trinity Lutheran, Brooklyn, New York. Hope Lutheran, Birmingham, Alabama. Our Savior Lutheran, Paradise, California. St. John Lutheran, Ray, Michigan. Peace with Christ Lutheran, Fort Collins, Colorado. Shepherd of the Hills Lutheran, Kimberling City, Missouri. The Lutheran Church of Our Savior, Salinas, California. St. John's Lutheran, Algoma, Wisconsin, and St. John's Lutheran, Colton, California. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print a one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, and click support. The Issues Etc. 300.
Hi, this is Pastor Mark Azil, the LCMS Director of Campus Ministry and LCMSU, inviting all college students and those with an interest in campus ministry to join us for Taboo, the 2015 National LCMS Campus Ministry Conference, this coming January 5th through 7th at St. Louis University in St. Louis. That's right, it's Taboo in the Lou. Find out more at lcms.org/LCMSU.
Clark, that's the gift that keeps on giving the whole year.
Maybe getting a faithful pastor seems as exciting as a membership in the Jelly of the Month Club, but that kind of thinking can lead to the unbiblical removal of pastors from the Office of the Holy Ministry, the topic of our next ACELC conference, February 10th through 12th in Kansas City, Missouri. Register at acelc.net because faithful pastors really are a gift that keeps on giving. See why at acelc.net.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
Our school is committed to authentic Lutheranism, the entire Book of Concord, and indeed to authentic Lutheranism as it has continued to be confessed and practiced through the centuries right up into our own time.
Dr. Cameron McKenzie, chairman of the Department of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana.
We're committed then to biblical, confessional Christianity and Lutheranism and applying it to the world of today in as effective a way as we can.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu, ctsfw.edu, or call 1-800-481-2155, Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.